Well, good morning and welcome again. And today we're diving into a new sermon series called All In. And probably when you hear the words all in, you know generally how this phrase is used. It's used when you're talking about when you take that leap of faith, when you jump in, when you are ready to make an investment, when you can't just have a foot in both worlds, but you have to go all in. And maybe you could think of a moment here, but I want to start off by sharing one of my moments. And there was this moment that happened to me in 2009. I just graduated college with a theology degree and was looking for work, and it was a time in our economy that was just a booming, incredible, flourishing economy, which is sarcasm because it was terrible. If any of you remember that time period, I applied to every Methodist church in the country and could not get a job. And so I decided, you know what, I'm going to try to apply to go to officer candidate school for the U.S. Navy. Maybe they'll take me. And so I put my application together. I ended up taking this test that measures your intelligence and then had to do fitness tests to get a recommendation and write this essay. And I thought, well, maybe God's calling me to do this. And I had some friends who were in the Navy. And so I had this different opportunity in front of me. And so weeks and months passed, and they weren't quick on making any decisions. But I finally got an interview in Jefferson City, Missouri. And as you all know, Jefferson City is the capital of our great state. And boy, it is, it's a really a tourist spot, isn't it? And so I remember driving into their little downtown part and thinking, oh, this place is pretty cool. I bet there's going to be a ton of young people here. Now, I was surprised when that wasn't the case. But I moved to town, and I was living with this church family for 2 days. 2 days. And I got this call from my recruiter. And so I answered on my cell phone, and I heard his voice, and he said, Chris, congratulations, great news. You've been accepted to officer candidate school for the United States Navy for the intelligence community. And I thought, oh, no. What do I do? What do I do? I just took this job. I just moved to Missouri. Like, what do I? And so I call my parents up, and I talked to them briefly, and I said, like, listen, guys, like, this worked out. And they immediately said, Chris, you need to move back home. You can stay with us for another couple months. That's really max we'll allow. And then you can go into the military. This is a no-brain decision. Like, you need to make this. And then keywords, you'll regret this the rest of your life if you don't take this opportunity. And so I wrestled with this. I was like, man, I just took this job. You know, am I going to be someone who just goes back on my word? I just made this commitment. And so I prayed and deliberated about it, and I ended up choosing to go all in with this ministry opportunity, to the delight of my family. Now, they end up, luckily, Mom, Tom, if you're watching this, you know, you guys, thank you for the encouragement. I know you're pretty happy now, but at the time, that was a scary choice. At the time, whether or not, you know, do you go all in with one opportunity or another? And you've probably had opportunities where you had to decide whether or not you were going all in. Maybe it was for you, it was on your wedding day, and you knew as you were standing there, oh, this is not just the next step, this is permanent. Like, I can't just halfway go into being married. I have to be married now. Like, this is I have to go all in here. Or maybe for you, you took the path that I didn't, and you signed those military papers, and you were shipping off, and there's no, you know what, actually, I'm not gonna do this, thank you, I'm gonna take another opportunity. You can't do that once you sign those papers. It was the day that you put down the bottle and you just decided, hey, listen, I can't go half-hearted into sobriety. I have to give it my all. That all of us could probably think of a time where we had to go all in with a decision or with a commitment. And so for the next 4 weeks, we're going to be talking about what it means when we go all in with certain aspects of our lives. And that's why we're going to be focusing on this. You see here, heart, soul, mind, and strength. We're focusing on a verse that many people are familiar with, especially if you grew up in church, you'll know this verse. But we're going to unpack a famous verse of Jesus's and talk about it in four different ways throughout this short series. And so here's the passage that we're taking this, that we're going to dissect for 4 weeks. And this is what it comes from. Jesus is asked by some religious leaders. They say, what is the greatest commandment? And he responds with this. And Jesus replied, the most important one is Israel. Listen, our God is the one Lord. And you must love the Lord your God with all of your heart and with all of your being or soul and with all of your mind and with all of your strength. Love God with all of these aspects. So today, we're going to focus on what it means to love God with all our heart. And the truth is, I'm not naive enough to think that sounds exciting. You know, when it comes to the concept of heart, it isn't something that we really hold in high regard in our culture and our society. If you were complimented, like, wow, you just have a great heart, you're like, oh, I'd rather be handsome or successful or, you know, something. I mean, heart, okay. Like, well, you might take it, but it's not something that we really aspire to. What I think of when I think of heart is, and this is a very generational reference here, but I think of this TV show that I watched growing up called Captain Planet. I don't know if you're familiar with this TV show. So if you don't know Captain Planet, here's the idea behind the show. Mother Earth decides, you know, that's enough of pollution. I need to have some warriors who will help me fight back the tides of pollution. And so she makes these five rings of power that she gives to these teenagers from around the world, and they come together, and when they use their rings together, Captain Planet shows up, and he makes everyone feel very comfortable with his appearance. And so, on, you know, these students, they have these incredible powers. Off to the left here is G. She has the ring of water, you know, kind of like Frozen. And then to the right of her is Wheeler. He's the American kind of hothead, and he has the ring of fire. And off to the very right, we have Linka, and she's a young Russian girl. She's got the ring of wind. And to her left is Kwame, and he's from Africa, and he's got the ring of earth. And they have these incredible power rings. But there's a fifth guy in a fifth ring, and you can barely see him. He's tucked in the back, kind of behind Captain Planet. Do you see him? That's some of you probably know this. Knowing my luck, there's probably like somebody here who like helped make the show or something. But his name is Mati. Mati's from South America, and he has the ring of, does anyone know? He has the ring of heart. Right. Great. I'm sure he's really happy he got that ring, right? He has all these people can control the elements, and he has the ring of heart, and you know what it allows him to do? He can talk to animals, you know? I'm sure that's very helpful fighting pollution. You know, it's kind of funny that we have this fifth heart, and it's kind of been a joke with millennials for years. If you grew up watching this show, like, they even have, like, spoofs and kind of skits making fun of this TV show, especially Mati and his poor ring of heart. But listen, it's not just the TV shows like this. Even when working with student ministry over the years, I find that sometimes parents, when they're talking about their kids, they'll use language of heart too. But generally, you know, it'll be in a conversation like this. Oh yeah, Susie, oh my gosh, she's such an amazing basketball player. She's our little athlete. Oh, and Rick, he's our little mathematician. Boy, is he smart. Oh, and then little Benny over here. Benny, he's got a great heart, right? That's kind of like, there's nothing, I don't really have anything else to say about Benny. He's a good kid, you know, like that's kind of how people talk about heart. But when it comes to Jesus, Jesus wasn't so dismissive of heart. Now, when it comes to Jesus, Jesus actually believed that the heart was a part of your life that influenced every other part of your life. It was a part of your life that impacts the world around you, your convictions and beliefs, the way that you have power in your life. He thought that the heart wasn't actually something to be dismissed, but something that was center to it all. And we see Jesus' ideas about this, and he speaks pretty strongly about it in a particular conversation that he has with some religious leaders. Now, the background on this next story that we're about to look at is that Jesus is pretty early in his ministry. He has his disciples. He's traveling from town to town. He's been doing these miracles, and he's been teaching people. And at this particular town, he's gathered his disciples, and they're around him, and the crowds are around him. And then some religious leaders and Pharisees show up. And while they're talking and while Jesus is teaching or something's going on, the disciples realize that they're hungry. And typically, for a good Jewish practitioner in the first century, before you ate anything, you would have to do a ritual where you were cleansed your hands. This is not the same as washing hands because they didn't know what germs were. But they had a ritual of hand cleansing that was part of their belief system. And every good practicing Jew knew about this practice. And so the disciples would have been aware of this, and yet they're hungry, and so they skip. They don't have any water and easy access, so they skip this ritual, and they start eating something at their disposal. And so the Pharisees at this point already realize that they're not looking to be allies with Jesus. They know that they're already looking to see him as a challenger, as an enemy, as somebody that they need to target or criticize. And so they're looking for every opportunity to bring negative attention to Jesus. He's already becoming too popular for their tastes. And so they begin to look and they notice that these disciples skip the ritual of hand washing and they go straight to eating. And so these Pharisees use this opportunity to criticize Jesus and to jump on Jesus. Now, part of this is because these Pharisees and some of the religious leaders, it was not uncommon for them to have disciples too. A disciple learned to be like the rabbi or the leader that they followed. And so these leaders usually chose the best of the best, the brightest and the most talented and the most intelligent and those who knew the law inside and out. And those would be the students of these rabbis or these leaders. And so for Jesus's students to not know this very basic thing made him look like an amateur leader, or made him look like he had a ragtag crew of individuals who were not the cream of the crop. And so this was a great opportunity to criticize Jesus' leadership in front of the crowd. And so they do, and they take this opportunity, and then the crowd kind of waits for Jesus' response. And this is what Jesus says. He says this. He replied, Isaiah, who's a prophet from a few hundred years earlier, who they would know from their scriptures. Isaiah really knew what he was talking about when he prophesied about you hypocrites. He wrote, this people honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far away from me. Their worship of me is empty, and since they teach instructions that are human words, you ignore God's commandments while holding on to rules created by humans and handed down to you. He just drops the mic. He drops the gauntlet. You know, he has this incredible moment, and the Pharisees and religious leaders are kind of speechless, and then Jesus doesn't let it just stay there. He turns to the crowd, and he uses it as a teaching opportunity, and he says this. He says, then Jesus called the crowd again and said, listen to me, all of you, and understand, nothing outside of a person can enter and contaminate a person in God's sight. So what they were worried about was when you don't do the ritual cleansing, what you eat then makes you ritually impure. You are not acceptable in God's sight if you eat this way. And so Jesus says, God's not concerned with the way you eat. Rather, the things that come out of a person contaminate the person. The things that come out of a person that contaminate the person. Now you might think, where's Jesus going with this? The disciples had the same question. And so later that night, after the crowds dismissed and dispersed, and Jesus and his disciples found a place to sit, they approached Jesus and had a question. And they had a question for a pretty good reason. See, these disciples, even though they were a little more of a ragtag crew, they still knew the rules that they were supposed to follow. They knew what they were supposed to do and not supposed to do. And they knew in that moment when the Pharisees caught them eating without having cleansed their hands, they knew they were in the wrong. They were like a deer in the headlights. And they were about to embarrass their master and leader and rabbi. And so they were caught in this moment. And so when Jesus instead says, forget those rules, that doesn't help anybody. What are you talking about? God doesn't care about this. This goes against everything that they had been raised with. This goes against everything that they thought about religion. This is shocking for them. It's not necessarily comforting for them because this is what they know inside and out. They knew they did something wrong. And so when Jesus is like, it doesn't matter. God doesn't care about that stuff. He's going against everything they grew up learning. And so this is a shocking moment. So they approach Jesus and they say, hey, listen, what was that about? Like, what did you mean back there? And this is what Jesus says. It says, after leaving the crowd, he entered a house where his disciples asked him about that riddle. And he said to them, don't you understand either? Don't you know that nothing from the outside that enters a person has the power to contaminate? He's basically saying, listen, this doesn't even make sense. If you eat a steak, it doesn't change your heart. It doesn't change who you are. It doesn't contaminate you. Why would God care what you eat about? And then he makes his point. And this is where he kind of expands it for his disciples. And prepare yourselves, because we don't talk about this in church a lot. He says this, that's because it doesn't enter into the heart, but into the stomach. So he says, what you eat doesn't go into your heart and change who you are. No, it goes out into your stomach and then out into the sewer, like you just saw earlier today when you went to the latrine, disciples. You know, like over there in that room, like that's where that food goes. It doesn't go into your heart. Why would it affect who you are? And then it says this, by saying this, Jesus declared that no food could contaminate a person in God's sight because they had very particular rules about eating. And then he adds this, it's what comes out of a person that contaminates someone. which is Jesus being pretty, making an interesting statement about poop. Believe it or not, you never thought you'd walk into church this morning hearing that word. But this is what he's saying. He's saying, listen, it's not what you put in your mouth that makes you, think about it. What's the part that's not clean? It's the stuff that comes out, not what goes in. And he's making a lesson here. He's saying it's both ends here. You know, you're concerned about what things you're supposed to eat, but what about the stuff that comes out of you? What about what's in your heart and comes out of you that way? Maybe that's the stuff that you should be more concerned about being unclean. And then he really goes into it here. Here's his next point. He says this, it's from the inside, from the human heart, that evil thoughts come. Sexual sins, thefts, murders, adultery, greed, evil actions, deceit, unrestrained immorality, envy, insults, arrogance, and foolishness. All of these evil things come from the inside and contaminate person in God's sight. He's basically saying that there's this stuff is as bad as what you left in the bathroom, and it comes out of you. It just comes out of a different end. Like, this is what Jesus is saying here. He's making a really interesting point. Like I said, we've probably never heard this preached before. But he's like, this, if you want to talk about uncleanliness, I'll talk about uncleanliness. Let's talk about what's left in the bathroom over here. Let's talk about what comes out of your mouth. Let's talk about the things that you do that don't start with what goes in your mouth, but what starts in your heart and goes the other way. Let's talk about that stuff. And Jesus in this moment is blowing the minds of his disciples. See, for them, this was a challenging thing because he was throwing away the things that they knew they were supposed to do. And there's a reason that this was challenging. It's because they were taught the way to they live their faith, not the why they live their faith. The way they live their faith, not the why they live their faith. They were taught to go through certain motions, do certain rituals, eat a certain way, pray a certain way, act a certain way, speak a certain way. But they were never taught why they were doing those things. They were never taught why it was important to be a different kind of person. They were never taught how your heart is supposed to be changed too. No, they were just taught about the things you're supposed to do. Now, luckily, the good news is today, we as a church don't care about whether or not you wash your hands. Now, your neighbor during passing of the peace might care if you have washed your hands. Can you imagine a world where, you know, the pastors wait outside the bathroom, and then as you come out, they shake your hand to make sure that it's still a little wet? You know, like, this is, like, thankfully, religion has evolved a little bit, right? But the reality is that we still, like, what Jesus quoted through Isaiah was that your lips, you know, say my name, but your heart's not with me. You go through the motions, but your heart's not in it. And the truth is that church has this same problem. For thousands and thousands of years, this is the challenge for religious movements. Is our heart in it, or are we just going through motions? And often, this is what it can look like today, to just go through the motions at church. And there's nothing wrong with this, but this, the motions look something like this. You're supposed to go to church. You attend church. You're not supposed to swear. You got to wear the right clothes. You know, you can't wear sandals to church. Somebody will judge you, which I hope no one's wearing sandals because I don't want you to feel called out. You have my blessing. By the way, when I got baptized as a teenager, my grandpa came to my church for the first time, and he was wearing sandals. And I remember I was horrified. He got in the car. I was like, Grandpa, you can't wear sandals to church. And he said, Jesus wore sandals. It's good enough for me. And I thought, okay. I don't have a response to that. You know, you think that being a Christian is just being nice or just giving money to good causes. You know, these are check boxes. Like, I'm just supposed to go through these motions, and that's what being a Christian is. But Jesus wasn't interested in going through the motions. Jesus was interested in the state of people's hearts because your actions and your motions will be different if your heart is different. He doesn't want people to just mimic the things you're supposed to do. He wants you to have convictions about what you need to do. Jesus wanted to start a movement of people who had a deep movement of the heart. And for him, heart did not mean generally what it means to us today. In English, the word heart means almost like just love or kind of affection. That's what we mean when we say heart figuratively. In Greek, though, it's the word cardia. And cardia is not just emotion. The figurative word usage of cardia is some translators say the base or the seat of your morality, of what you think is right or wrong, your convictions, your passions, your deep set beliefs. Like, this is what Jesus means when he says have heart, is you shouldn't be just going through the motions. You should believe in something and then act. This is what he's saying. And if here's some examples of what today maybe that will feel like. Cardia today, that heart today, what it feels like is when you have a moment and there's an opportunity to do something that you know is wrong. Somebody presents it or you have an opportunity and you feel this rising up in your heart. You feel this rising up in your gut of this feeling of, I'm not this kind of person. I'm not going to take that step. You feel that stand. You feel that kind of almost indignant energy come up. That's heart. Or when you are watching TV or you see something out in the world and you see an injustice that's happening and you feel like this energy rise up and this surge of this feeling of like we need to stop this, that something's wrong with that. You know, that's your conviction, that's your heart, your cardia, it's rising up. Or when you see a cause that you believe in and you take some money that you could easily, that we have a world that tells keep it to yourself, and you say, no, I'm going to give a little bit of what's mine because I want to see it make a difference. I believe in something, and so I'm going to give of myself in some way. You know, that's cardia, that's this heart, this conviction, this energy, this passion. That's what Jesus was talking about. And this is what he wanted in people. And this is what he was challenging the religious leaders to see in the day, is to actually believe in something. To actually believe in something. And see, the reality is that the church has this problem still today. And I'm sure all of us could probably name some Christian in our lives who goes through the motions. And I don't want to mock people like that or belittle. I just meaning that when that becomes the norm, when that becomes the default for a church, and we start to just go through the motions, we don't realize that there's stakes to that. There's stakes to that. And what we put at stake is this: people. We put people's lives at stake when we don't let our faith actually take root in our heart, when we don't go all in when it comes to heart. That there are stakes, and it involves human beings. You've probably heard this quote from Gandhi. Gandhi died in, I think, 1948. He was assassinated for being inclusive in his society. Ironically, he was assassinated by zealot Hindu who was angry at Gandhi for wanting to be inclusive to Muslims. Like, it's hard to fathom in today's world. But this is why he was killed. And Gandhi used Jesus' tactics a lot in his nonviolent protests and the way he implemented change in India. And so Gandhi at one point said this about Jesus. He says, I like your Christ. I do not like your Christians. Your Christians are so unlike your Christ. And he would have known this because he read the Bible. He took tips from Jesus' own ministry. And this is what he came away with. And there are people that if we don't get it right, they will walk away. This last weekend, a week ago, we retreated with our leadership council. And our leadership council is folks from our church. And it's 9 people who are nominated and elected into this leadership council that helps guide the strategy and the vision of our church. So that keeps a new pastor for me coming in and willy-nilly just going wherever I want with the church. That's not how it works. I work with this group of people who prayerfully and respectfully help guide the future of the church. And so we went away for this morning retreat, and one of the things we were talking about was I was trying to ask them this question. Why do we do church? Why we do church? There's no question mark there, but this is the topic we were trying to focus on. Because what ends up happening with church after church after church after church is that we instead focus on the way we do church. We focus on the way we do church and not why we do church. You see all sorts of people who are focused on just the particulars and the things that they want to see, and they moved the chairs, or the songs aren't what I like, or the, you know, something on the stage is different, or they didn't do my event. You know, people get really, they think that the focus and the priority is the way that we do church. And for a church to thrive and grow and be healthy, you have to put the why in front of the way. And so what I said to our leadership council, I said, for me, the why we do church is people. And when I pray about why this church exists and why I do church, God puts and impresses upon me this family. And this is just the way that sometimes when I pray about who our church is going to reach. God impresses on me this family who's living out here, maybe in the houses across the street over here, or maybe in the townhouses over this way. But I imagine this family who's young, and they're working hard, and they've got a few kids, and they're kind of stretched thin, and they're busy, and they haven't really found a church. They're interested in church, but they haven't really found one. They're not sure if they would like one, or they tried one once. You know, their kids, they think their kids should be in church, but they're really not sure how it can make an impact. And they haven't really focused on their marriage very much. They've kind of just been trying to raise the kids, and so they haven't been intentional with each other. And they're on this path that maybe in 15 or 20 years will lead to a separation. And for some reason, they're overwhelmed with life, and they don't have a lot of their high school friends are in the same place, but they're not, they're kind of surface level friendships, and they can't really go deep or ask some of the deeper things of life, and they feel like there's hunger, but they don't, it's kind of just there all the time, so they don't even know they're hungry for something more. And I imagine if that family could find our church and find faith and have something that was a little more real, what would happen is they'd step into a place where hopefully they find some friends or a small group or a Sunday school class, and they start to have some deeper conversations about life that maybe they haven't had in a long time, or if they've ever had them at all. And then they end up finding teachers in the Sunday school program who love their kids almost as much as they do. And they, every time they walk away, they're like, oh my goodness, it feels so good to have other adults who just love my kids outside of just programs at the school. And this family who comes in and they hear messages and they learn more about faith and how they're supposed to take a little bit of time and build some margins for themselves and how they can be more intentional as parents and how they can grow towards each other and put aside their differences and lean into one another and have a different outcome for their lives. I mean, all of that, what happens in church and what happens with faith, it's not about just a service or a building or a property. No, it's about life, what happens with life. It's about the heart. And when you change the heart, it changes everything. And this is what Jesus desired. And so I said to our leadership council, I was like, all right, when you pray, I'm going to give you some time here. Who do you think of that's out there whose life would be different if they found faith here? Who do you think of? And I let them have a few minutes, and they wrote down some stuff, and I had them break out into groups and talk about it, and we came back together, and then I wrote down, I asked everybody to share, and we wrote down, it looked like this sheet of paper here, and I wrote down each of these different people that somebody on our leadership council came up with. And there's, 9 or 10 of these, and so I just want to read a few of them. One person said, there's a single dad out there who's taking care of his kids, and he's got a busy job, and he feels guilty, and he's exhausted, and he wants to take his kids to church, but he feels like he'd stand out because he's in a non-traditional family, and so he just doesn't come to church because he doesn't feel like he belongs. Or someone else said that there's a couple in their 60s, and they lost a close member of their family, and they're grieving, but they've kind of drifted away from church, and now that they need some people in their lives, they're not sure how to reconnect, and they're not sure how to get back in and how to even develop friendships at this stage of life. Someone else imagined a couple with kids, and one of the kids has special needs, and they're asking this question, when we go to church, will the church accept our family and our kid who's different? Will they be able to provide and be there and support our family? Or will we just be like someone who just slips in and out and no one really knows we're there? Someone else said that they imagined another couple in their 50s or 60s. They've got an empty nest. They have a faith of their own, but they don't have a connection to church. Their oldest son came out as gay, and they're so supportive of him, but they're afraid if they go to church, they're going to find what church is going to be supportive of their son. And so they think that just when they go to church, they're just going to face judgment. And so this is what they feel about. They're afraid to come to church because they're afraid of the judgment of the church. And lastly, someone imagined a single mom with two jobs. Kids are getting into trouble at school. And church is a luxury she doesn't have. She can barely get sleep, let alone get to church. And yet if she found a home here, she could find a group of people who lifted her up and supported her and did life with her. The church can't fix everybody's problems, but the church can offer hope and offer community and offer heart in the midst of life. And this is what we sometimes miss. Now, I want to close with this example. Okay, now when the church is at its best, a place like this becomes an oasis for those people. And hopefully you've felt a little bit of this. And sometimes when a church starts to focus on the outside, people can start to feel like, hey, what about me? Why are we focusing on these outside people? And the truth is that the church was here for you. Why would it just stop there? Why would it stop because you got something? What about this person who hasn't found that? yet. And this is what church is supposed to be. But don't take my word for it. Luke writes in the book of Acts about what the early church looked like and what Jesus set up the church to be and where we should take some notes from. And this is what he says in Acts. He says this: the community of believers was one in heart and mind. Think about that. Was one in cardia. Was one in their convictions and in their passions and in their dreams and in their hopes. They were one in those feelings. They were one in this conviction that God will use us for something more. This is what they believed in. And none of them would say, this is mine, about any of their possessions or about their pew or about the style of worship or about where things were on the stage or about who's raising money in the lobby. Did I read something into that? But held everything in common. And then it continues, the apostles continued to bear powerful witness to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and an abundance of grace was at work among them all. Among them all. This was the key to what made the early church a movement that changed the world, is that they were not driven by a checklist of things they were supposed to do. They were moved by their heart. They were moved by their heart. And this is what defined the early church. Now, what's cool, what's happening in the 6 months that I've been here, I've seen some really cool stuff happen in our church. And some of you have probably seen this too. In the last 6 months, we've seen an increase of worship attendance of about 50 people on average a weekend from this time last year, which is really exciting. It's really beautiful. I love the energy and the people and the community that we're finding here. In fact, I looked back, when was the last time we saw this kind of growth in our church? And it's been 17 years since we've seen this kind of influx. 17 years. And I don't believe it's because some millennial up here in semi-skinny jeans. I don't think that's the key. No, I think it's, as a church, we've gotten to a place where we are focusing more on the why instead of the way. As a church, we're focusing more on why we're supposed to exist. We're focusing more on the heart behind what faith is. And we've been exploring this together. A new pastor alone cannot do that. No, a community does that. And people will be magnetized to this community if we continue to be a place of heart, if we continue to be a place of united convictions, if we put our why in front of our way. This church will see days, and God will use us to do some incredible things. And people will have stories about how this church changed their life because of how God used it. And I want that for us, and I want that to be part of our story. So I want to end with this. I want to ask you a few questions. When was the last time when it came to faith, that your heart was full? When was the last time you felt that you were all in when it came to your faith? You know, was it back in youth group and you felt like you had this, you know, this unit of friends? Was it in a Bible study you had? Was it in a deep conversation? Was it in your prayer or Bible time and you felt like God spoke to you? You know, when was the last time you felt a fullness of your heart and really went all in when it came to your convictions? When was the last time? And maybe you haven't felt that. And no matter where you are, I want to invite you, as we close in a prayer, I want to invite you to give your heart over to God. To say, God, listen, I want to be all in with something. I don't want to be someone who just has a foot in both worlds or is teeter-tottering on everything in life. I don't want to be someone who focuses on the wrong things. I want to put the why before the way. God, like, use me. Like, yes, I want my heart to be full in that way. And if that's you, then I just invite you to join me in this prayer. And as we pray, I like to pray sometimes with my hands open like this. I find that a physical posture helps a spiritual openness. And so as we pray, I invite you to hold your hands open like this. And then silently, if you want to pray with me, you can pray with me. But I invite you now to join me in this prayer. God, I've made all sorts of priorities in my life, but not my heart. Help me knock away the stone that surrounded my conscience, the apathy that's numbed my convictions. I want to go all in when it comes to you. And so, God, let your why be more important than my way, and help me love you more every day.